Chapter 11. Rachel had not been happy. "I'm going to kill them," she snarled. "If you tried, you'd end up just like me," Danae said, shivering. Herzer's cloak was a better fit for her than for the boy, but it was still a poor substitute for her rain gear, and she knew she was still shocky from the trauma of the rape. "I didn't lie through my teeth just so that you could get raped, too. Leave it." Azure, already wet and annoyed, wandered around her sniffing and yowling. He sniffed at Herzer as well, and seemed ready to bite, but finally he left off and wandered into the woods, sniffing at the ground. "There's nothing you can do, Rachel," Herzer said tonelessly. "You can just butt out, Herzer Herrick," Rachel snapped. "Where in the hell were you, huh?" "Too late to do anything," Danae said. "Leave off, Rachel. We need to get on our way." "What about the snares?" she said. "We can't keep moving without food. Azure needs to eat at the very least." "He won't start getting sick for another day or two," Danae said tiredly. "If we move fast, we can make it to the Via in a day at most. There are towns up there. We'll find something to eat." "How far up the road did you go?" Herzer asked. "Only a kai or so," Rachel said. "The trail is knee-deep in mud up the way. Mom, I don't know if you can make it." "I'll make it," Danae said, standing up. "I'll make it all the way. But I'm not going to wait here for Mechanic and his band of merry men to find me again. Let's go." "God, I hope Dad is still in Raven's Mill," Rachel said, gathering up their few belongings. "He will be," Danae replied. "I just hope that he's willing to overlook the last few years." "Home is where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in," Herzer said quietly. He automatically took the front position, picking up Danae's pack and slinging it on his back. "He'll be there, and he'll be waiting for you." "He'd better be," Danae said bitterly. "Nay, nay, you have to heat it more, or you'll be hammering all day to no effect," Edmund growled, picking up the piece of metal with tongs and setting it back in the charcoal fire. "I'm sorry, sir, I thought..." The apprentice stepped back and looked around at the group gathered in the forge. A few weeks before, all he'd had to worry about was what to wear to the next party. Now he was trapped in this cluttered workshop, learning a trade so ancient that until the previous week he had never heard of it, and doing badly at it. It didn't seem fair. "It takes years to learn the blacksmith trade," the smith replied, more softly, noting the glance. He jerked a chin at the bellows and waited as the apprentice pumped the fire hot. "Watch the color of the metal and the colors of the fire around it. When it gets white hot, pull it out and then strike. You don't have much time. That's why they say you have to strike while the iron is hot." He lent emphasis to the words, pulling the piece out and hammering it flat, then turning it to shape. "Just a hoe, but hoes are what will feed us all soon enough. Hoes and plows and parts for wagons will be your mainstay once you learn." He thrust the half-formed metal back into the fire and jerked his chin at one of the other hovering apprentices. "Now you tend the fire while he tries again." He stepped back and wiped at his face as the fledgling smith tried to get the recalcitrant metal to do his will, trying not to shake his head. With the scraps and bars that Angus had brought in, they had enough material for the beginnings of a community, but they'd soon need more. He had sent a wagon load of mixed foodstuffs up the road to Angus, but the distance was far enough that the oxen would eat a good bit of the load on the way, and it would be 3 or 4 weeks before any response could come. "What about weapons?" the apprentice asked, finally getting the hoe to form. He had got the rhythm of the hammer, and sparks struck a brilliant white in the dim forge. "You're a long way from making a weapon, son, other than a spear blade, which is not more than a hoe shaped a bit differently. But swords and such, or armor, they take a tad more work. Once we have the wire puller going in the water forge, we'll get some of you to work on mail. But for the time being, it's more important to learn how to make farming utensils." He looked out the door of the shed again, then peered more carefully. "You all start working on hoes from this stock. I'll be back in a bit." Stepping out of the heat of the forge, he shielded his eyes against the sun. As if in expiation for the unending rains, the skies had cleared and turned bright for the last few days as the sodden ground steamed. The temperature hadn't gone up much, but the humidity was still high, giving the area a damp chill that sapped energy and made everyone hungry for fats and carbohydrates that were in short supply. But the bright sun and haze made seeing anything at a distance difficult. which was why Edmund had to look long and hard to be sure of what he saw. Then he let out a whoop and headed down to town. "Class dismissed for the next hour or so," he called over his shoulder. "Try not to burn down the forge while I'm gone." He thought about grabbing a horse, but decided that it would take more time and trouble than just walking down the hill. As he entered the town of Raven's Mill, which was growing in all four directions, he could see a large crowd gathered around the three wagons that had come from the east, and he pushed his way through to the center without thought until he approached the first wagon, which had stalled for lack of room to move. "Suisa, you're a sight for goddamn sore eyes," he shouted, clambering up the side of the wagon and enfolding the muscular driver in his arms. "Why, Edmund," the woman laughed, giving him a hug in return, "I didn't know you cared. I've been trying to run this madhouse and simultaneously teach newbies who are as hard-headed as the metal they can't shape," he laughed. "So I'll admit it's a purely selfish reaction." "I should have guessed," she replied with a grin. "Ola, Phil," he called to the man driving the second wagon. "Still selling the condemned mead?" "Aye, enough to drown you in if you don't quit manhandling my wife," the man called back. "Let me get this cluster out of the way and get the wagons up to the forge. I assume you brought all your tools with you?" "And spare anvils and a small forge," Suisa replied, "and all of Phil's beekeeping supplies. Forges and anvils we have, tools we're lacking, and hives for that matter. We're going to have a long talk." As he and a group of the newly forming guard force opened a path for the wagons, Edmund considered the priceless asset that had arrived. He had known Suisa for at least 75 years and had occasionally considered asking her to become his apprentice. The problem with that was that by the time they became friends, she was a master smith in her own right. He knew things about forming metal that she did not, but the reverse was also true, and the level of his mastery over hers was an incremental thing. Just as an example, he mostly worked in hot forging with metal heated to brightness, whereas she generally used preformed plates for cold forging. He was undeniably superior at the first, while she had a slight edge on him in the latter. She also concentrated on plate armor and decorative works, while he specialized in blades. So it was more a matter of complementary styles than superior-inferior. In the end, he decided that if no appropriate apprentice made an appearance by the time he was getting too old to work the forge, he would probably gift it to her, along with Carborundum. He was pretty sure that they would get along, and judicious soundings had indicated that she had very few reservations about AIs. But with the fall and his increasing responsibilities, he had despaired of having anyone come along who could take over the training of the new smiths. Smithing was nearly as vital as farming in a pre-industrial economy, and the number of tools that they were going to need prior to the beginning of the planting season was staggering. Furthermore, he knew that his personality was not at the best teaching raw newcomers to the trade, especially ones he hadn't carefully chosen. Suisa was much more patient with the sort of ham-handedness he had been despairing of this morning. He got the wagons up to the backside of town, just short of his house, left them with a couple of the guards and one of their pair's grown children, and led the couple up to the house. Suisa looked at the expanded sheds and whistled. "How many smiths do you have in this place now?"
"One," Edmund replied bitterly. "I'm the only one who has made it in yet, except you. I know that there were more in walking distance of the mill, but some of the other communities are forming up as well, and I guess they made it to them. Or they were on the other side of the world when the fall hit."
"Who all has made it here?" Phil asked. "If you mean of our crowd, quite a few. But, well, you know most reenactors. They don't actually know diddly shit about period life, or for that matter, pre-industrial technology. And they're all happy to swing swords for a bit, but then they want their meal served on silver platters."
"I won't disagree on that, but this is tough," Suisa said. "Taking a few weeks to travel by wagon and sleep on the ground for fun is one thing. Having to do it for survival is another."
"I know," Edmund said, leading the way into his house. He waved them into chairs around the fire, then poked it back to life and pulled out a jug of cider that had been warming by the coals. When he had them comfortable, he continued. "I know that things are tough," he continued, "but until one faction or the other of the council wins, this is what life is going to be. And we have to make it as good as we can within these parameters."
"Or until one side gives up," Suisa said, taking a sip of the cider.
"I don't think that's going to happen," Edmund replied.
Paul is in too deep and is too fanatical, I guess is the best word, and Chida thinks the world, even as devastated as it has become, would be worse off under Paul's unrestricted control. I don't know that I fault her there, Phil agreed. We heard some really weird rumors on the way over here. You mean about Paul changing people to fit the conditions of the fall better? Edmund asked. We've heard the same. But it's always somebody's brother who heard it from somebody else. Doesn't Shida know? Suissa asked. I haven't talked to her in 2 weeks, so I don't know if she does or not. So what do you want us to do? Phil asked. Well, in Suissa's case, I want her to take over training all the apprentices and turning out metalwork, Edmund admitted. I'm up to my ass in alligators every day, and I have neither the time nor the patience to handle a gaggle of apprentices. Mallory and Christopher can help with that as well, Suissa said with a nod. Right now it's all farm implements, Edward warned. Real blacksmithing. But in time we're going to need armor and swords. I'm still working on the guard force, but the plan is to produce a professional military as well. And there's a training program starting, so you're going to have to set up an orientation to blacksmithing, basically what the job of an apprentice is, and a few tricks for farmers. Most of the people going through the orientation are going to end up farming. All right, and how do I get paid? Suissa asked. Right now the basis of what currency we have is food chits. You can use them to trade for meals in the chow halls, or you can get raw food to cook yourself. We'll figure out something equitable for your training time, and, of course, you'll get paid for your finished materials. We haven't really got an economy beyond that, and it's all based on Myron's supplies. This is going to be fun, Phil said. That's an inflationary economy if I've ever heard of one. Well, yes and no. Most people get 3 food chits per day. If they starve themselves, they have extra money. Skilled artisans get 4 for days spent working on communal projects. And they can try to find materials to trade for more. But there's not much surplus floating around. So far, by restricting the chits, we're both controlling the food supply, which is really important, and keeping the economy non-inflationary. Sooner or later, we'll get large enough. We have to come up with a better system. But for right now, it's working. There are too many other problems for me to want to knock it. Such as, Suissa said, you've heard about the bandits? There was a group of 5 guys who tried to, I don't know, hold us up, Phil said. They had a few sticks and a knife. We pulled out 3 swords and a crossbow. They lost interest really quick. Edmund chuckled for a moment, then shook his head. One of the things I'm worried about is that the small communities have all the food and other goods, but right now food is paramount. Sooner or later, the bandit gangs are going to start banding together and attacking the towns. I want to be ready for them before they do. If there's one thing that reenactors can do, it's swing a sword, Suissa said with a gesture in the general direction of the town. Not as well as they think they can, and that assumes they have them, Edmund said with a frown. Most of them started out from whatever they came from with a sword or a bow or a glaive of some sort. And most of them left them somewhere as well. They're heavy, don't you know? Damn, Phil said, shaking his head. And frankly, I'd rather have raw recruits than most reenactors with live blades. We're going to form a militia, and everyone is going to learn at the minimum to defend themselves. But I want a professional military at the core. 2-tiered for right now. Longbow and line infantry. The line infantry based loosely on Roman legions. Why longbow? Suissa asked. Crossbow is easier to train. A lot of reasons, Edmund replied. Both of them have their pros and cons, and you have to understand. Despite the last week or so, I'm talking with Shida fairly often. I'm starting to get a grasp of what the strategic situation is and how it might fall out. So I'm thinking in terms not of days or weeks, but of years of war. Shit, Phil said. You'd hope this would be over quick and we could go back to our lives. I don't think that's what's going to happen. I'm not sure we'll be able to go back to our lives even after the war is over. But we were talking about longbows. Okay. Longbows and crossbows both have their pros and cons. Some of them are universal and some of them were specific to the conditions. Okay, here's one. What's the only wood you can use for a longbow that is made in Ropasa? Yew, Suissa answered. Well, okay, yew and ash. But you can use hickory. Oh, right. One of the reasons for longbow rarity in Ropasa was the lack of materials, which meant a longbow cost a lot. And towards the end, the Britons had to import all their yew from the continent, which was a critical strategic fault in the system. But in Norah, hickory makes an excellent longbow, and it is widely available. Here, longbows can be made by anyone with a knife and some knowledge. Cons of the longbow are rarity of materials. We covered that. Difficulty of training and the fact that you have to have very physically able persons to use it. That is, they have to be physically strong and in good shape, not sick. Taking the last first, we're not dealing with medieval peasants. The human of today, even those who are not changed, are the result of multiple generations of tinkering. Do you know what dysentery is? Only from history, Phil said. Diarrhea. Runny guts, as they used to call it. Right. The most common reason for dysentery was water that was contaminated with the Giardia cyst. On the way here, did you drink from streams? Sure, we always have, Suissa said. Why? Did you get diarrhea? No. That's because you're immune to the effect of Giardia. Also, the common flu, typhoid, syphilis, and a host of other bacteriological and viral infections. We're born that way. It's bred into us. Just as greater strength, both for men and women, is innate. Women of today have the potential to be as strong as the average man was in the 1300s, and men have the potential to be enormously stronger. Furthermore, the basic human material we have now, from the refugees, is so much better than the average medieval peasant, it doesn't bear discussion. Taller, stronger, healthier, everything that you need for the baseline of a decent longbow archer. Most of that relates to crossbows as well, Phil said stubbornly. Except for height, yes, Edmund replied. But the point is, it takes away one of the cons of longbows. The next one is training. Well, I've seen people train to be competent, not expert, but competent bowmen in 4 to 6 months. And as they continue to train, they get better and better. By next fall, I want to have a small but growing longbow corps. And in a few years, I want it to be a large and growing longbow corps. But none of that touches on crossbows, Phil replied. Okay, what are the pros of longbows? They have a higher rate of firepower, for the same training than crossbows. That is, they can put out nearly twice as many arrows in an hour, and more for short periods. They are easier to manufacture. A trained bowyer with seasoned wood can turn out a longbow in an hour, and their training is identical to that for compound bows. You mean composite? Phil asked. I'm not sure you want to use those. The glues we've had to use to make horn bows are hydroscopic. They're really only good in very dry conditions. Phil, I've been doing this for nigh on 300 years, Edmund said, letting the first sigh of exasperation through. Give me the benefit of using the right term. No, I mean compound, the ones with the pulleys. You can use a bow that is nearly twice the standard strength of a longbow with compound bows because the archer only takes the full weight of the pull for about 10% of the draw, and the hold strength is a fraction of the full strength. But right now, we don't have the logistics to produce them in quantity. However, in time we will. And then we'll have archers who can be easily cross-trained to bows that have 5 times the potential, in combination of pull and rate of fire, of any reasonable crossbow. Hmm, was Phil's reply. Maneuvering is another problem with archers, Suissa interjected. Less so with crossbowmen. Not really, they both had the same problem, Edmund said. Resupply. Archers going into battle have to have crates and barrels of arrows. Also spare bows and other things. I've got some ways to fix that as well. We'll use modern training techniques for them, and for the line infantry, and a 4,000-year history of maneuver that wasn't conceived of for most of history, and generally lost even after it had been developed. You've thought about this carefully, Suissa said. As carefully as I can. There's more to it than that. He paused and wondered if he really knew Suissa well enough to cover the rest, but then shrugged. Have you realized that this might be a multi-generational thing? No, Philip said, then blanched. That long? If Shida wins, and that's a big if, it might not be soon. I'm not even sure how to win this war, and I've studied every war in history. I'm having to juggle now constraints with thinking about what the long-term effect will be of everything we do. Take crossbows versus longbows. A longbow, as I said, can be made by anyone with a knife and some knowledge. There's plenty of game, so in a few years every farmer in the area will be trying his hand at bringing in the odd deer. I want them to have a template for the weapon to use, because if we have a solid and large yeomanry of trained bowyers, having any sort of aristocratic class arise will be difficult. Hard to be a lord when any serf with a grudge can knock you off the horse, Suissa said. Tricky. I'm trying as hard as I can to replicate post-industrial republics, Edmund admitted. Making crossbows, especially good ones that can kill a knight, is a hell of a lot harder than making longbows, or even compound bows. I want it to be understood at the core of the society that the right to weapons is a fundamental right. As long as you have a relatively law-abiding society, weapons in general ownership and use prevent tyranny from taking hold. Nothing else in history has ever managed it. There's a difference between a professional bowman and a farmer who kills the occasional deer, Phil argued. Sure, but it's a difference of details, not the quantitative difference between a knight in armor and a serf with a pitchfork. Phil shrugged reluctant agreement to that, then grinned. You won't mind if I built crossbows, will you? Not at all, as long as you sell them to anyone with money, Talbot agreed with an unusual grin. We're just a small little outpost of civilization in a world that's turning to barbarism. Historically, the barbarians tend to win. Not as long as I'm in charge. Okay, we'll build you your arms and armor. Just use it right, Suissa said. Hey, Phil interjected. You can get a superior bend to the bow with beryllium bronze. That means you can get nearly as good a loft out of a light crossbow as from a longbow, and nearly the firepower. Do you know how to cast beryllium bronze? Edmund asked. No. Well, I do, but I'm not going to spend all my time doing casts for crossbows, okay? Okay, Phil said with a laugh. Speaking of casts, he added, there's somebody you need to meet. I didn't know you were friends with any AIs, Suissa said, mopping her face at the heat from the forge. Hello, Carborundum. Well, there's a lot about me you don't know, Edmund replied. How goes it, soulless fiend? It's bloody cold is how it goes, Carborundum said. And the net is well and truly screwed. Your friends Shida and Paul between them have put up blocks bloody everywhere. We're a bit short on carbon at the moment, old fiend, Edmund said, then scooped up a generous helping nonetheless and tossed it onto the red glowing coals. He wiped the black soot from his hands and shrugged. We're cooking some charcoal now, but it's a slow business and the wet isn't helping. Lystra says only another couple of days in this region, Carb added, and I'm sorry, but I'm still not finding anything on Rachel and Danae. The fairies are circulating back word on people moving in the wilderness, but of course they don't know one human from another. They were definitely at the house, both of them, at the fall, and the house hob said they left, but that's all I've got. Some of the AIs are being really uncommunicative. Some of them are on Paul's side, mostly because they think he's going to win. And direct access to the net is generally cut off between Shida and Paul's blocks. Thank you, Carb. I've got Tom out looking as well. Well, I'll tell you if anything comes up. Thank you again, but I'm introducing you to Suissa for a reason. I'm going to have to be more and more connected to this mayor business, and she's going to be taking over the smithing and armoring, so I'm probably not going to be seeing you much. I'm sorry to hear that, Carb said. Honestly, I know you're busy, but don't be a stranger. I won't. I hope you and Suissa get along, though. Oh, I'm an old hand at breaking in new smiths, Carb said with a laugh like a couple of plates of iron striking. And I'm an old hand at old hands, Suissa said. You were mentioning a need for charcoal, I believe? Arr! Edmund, come back! You two have fun, Edmund said, turning to the door. And Suissa, you need to come meet your class soon. I'll do that. After I get done discussing things with Carborundum here. When do you think Tom will get back? Phil asked as the two of them stepped back into the rain. In a day or two, I'd suppose. And then you'll know? Phil, I may never know, Edmund replied softly.